After months of waiting, the new Hobbit movie opened this weekend. The second in director Peter Jackson's new Tolkien trilogy.
Grave danger.
The world is in grave danger.
Now, for Tolkien fans, the names alone cast a spell. Bilbo Baggins, Gandalf the Grey, orcs and trolls, and above all, hobbits, the most beloved of all Tolkien's characters. What's behind the perennial appeal of the halflings? Writer Noble Smith believes it's the philosophy of life woven into Tolkien's epic fantasies. He's the author of The Wisdom of the Shire, a short guide to a long and happy life, and he joins us today for a conversation about all things hobbity, about elves, wizards, and the Shire. We're calling on all Tolkien fans to join in. Let's see if we can't conjure up Middle Earth right here on the radio. Who's your favorite character in Tolkien's books, and why? And what do you love about the Tolkien books? You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And Noble, welcome to 45 North.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So I will be one of those people standing in line to see the new Hobbit movie this weekend. It opened last night at midnight. Did you go?
I did go.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I went and I had a blast, and it was funny because I'm 45 years old, and my friend who went with me is the same age, and we were like the oldest people in the audience.
Which is a really lovely thing when you consider that those of us who are now in middle age grew up with these books, fell in love with them as teenagers, and now a whole second, even third generation of teenagers still loves them.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's enduring. I think hundreds of years from now, people will feel the same about these books.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think of the movie?
I liked it.
Yeah?
I don't want to, you know, do that spoiler thing. But I think it was better than the first one.
Oh, well, that's saying a lot. Usually the second ones aren't. So a couple of things. There are a few changes to the book. For one thing, Legolas the elf is in this one. For anybody who remembers The Lord of the Rings, Legolas has his own fan club, the beautiful Orlando Bloom with that long, silky blonde hair, and he can, you know, leap about from mountaintop to mountaintop. So what did you think of Legolas?
Legolas, he puts the sin in Sindarin elf. I just, you can actually go online today to the Huffington Post and see a blog, it's kind of like a little piece that I put up there. About Legolas, the top 10 things you may not know about Legolas.
Okay, you have to tell us some of them. Though I warn you, I know a lot about Tolkien. Let's see if you can surprise me.
Yeah, he has insomnia.
Really?
Yeah. These are kind of silly things, but...
Wait, elves don't sleep?
They don't, really. They don't have to. But they can kind of go into this weird waking dream life. Dream state thing. And so they can sleep on their feet when they're running.
That's a useful trick. How do you know that? Does that come up in any of the movies or books?
It's sort of, there's some of the, Tolkien talks about it in the Silmarillion and in the letters. The letters of J.R.R. Tolkien are a great resource for people who want cool little tidbits. Not only about Middle Earth, but about Tolkien the man. And I first read the letters when I was a kid, and you realize that this guy, J.R.R. Tolkien, was just a wonderful person. He was like a hobbit. And
he was like a hobbit?
He was, yeah. And he was this great dad, and I think that's another reason that people love these books so much, is because you know that the author was just such a wonderful human being.
But what do you mean when you say he was like a hobbit?
Well, he said that he was like a hobbit to people, except for his size, of course.
So he wasn't 4 feet tall?
No, he was of average height. But he loved to just hang out with his family and friends and have good beer and loved smoking his pipe and taking long walks in the countryside. He loved trees.
Okay, I see what you mean. That all does sound like hobbits. We should go back to talking a bit about the movie. Actually, I think we've got a clip. The thing that a lot of fans have been waiting for is this is the first time we really see the dragon, Smaug, played by actor Benedict Cumberbatch. And here's a bit from the trailer that's been whetting our appetite.
I will not risk this quest for the life of one burglar.
His name is Bilbo.
That actually sounds like more than one Benedict Cumberbatch talking as the dragon Smaug.
Yeah. I love Benedict Cumberbatch's voice, and I think he puts the mel in mellifluous.
So critics are saying that this is like the best portrayal of a dragon ever. What makes it so good?
I think that it's because they anthropomorphize the dragon in such a way that you just know that he's smart, he's diabolical, he's not just this kind of idiot monster that attacks, and he's toying with Bilbo, and he does it in the book too, and he's vain, he's very vain. There's a part in the book where Bilbo is flattering him, and Smaug is like, oh, yes, really? You want to see what I really look like? And he, like, you know, puffs out his chest, and it's all kind of encrusted with jewels that he's been lying on for, you know, hundreds of years or however long he's been in Erebor. And that's when Bilbo sees the missing tile from his scales.
Oh, the chink in his armor.
Yes, indeed.
Well, so he sounds like a very complex character. So I'm curious. I have a confession. I read The Lord of the Rings for the first time when I was 12 or 13, and I just fell into those books. I mean, like, I read them back to back, and then I began again, and then again. I probably read them 5 times in a row.
Yeah, me too.
6 months. And then I taught myself Elvish for a little bit.
Oh,
so
cool.
So I am a former Tolkien geek. I hope that doesn't put off everybody listening. But how about you? When did you fall in love with Tolkien?
Yeah, I was about 11 or 12. And the funny thing is back when I first discovered Tolkien, I started out playing Dungeons and Dragons first. And I actually have a website that's a Dungeons and Dragons nostalgia site that I do with author Ethan Gilsdorf, who wrote Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks.
Uh-huh.
It's an amazing book. Anyway. So,
did you know Dungeons and Dragons was invented in Wisconsin?
I did know that. Gary Gygax, yes, indeed. And that's pretty cool. And Ethan actually went to visit his home.
Yeah, I think it's Lake Geneva, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think Lake Geneva is even putting up a monument. Okay, so somebody's going to call
and tell us more
about Gary Gygax and his Wisconsin connections. I just 800-642-1234. We've got to have some Dungeons and Dragons fans listening.
Definitely.
Who will call and fill us in with some more information. Okay, so you fell in love with Lord of the Rings for the first time. You were what, 11, 12?
Yeah, I was about 12, and nobody told me to read it. It wasn't like teachers were, you know, pushing the book on you. And the book, the copy of The Fellowship of the Ring that I checked out from the library hadn't been checked out in 20 years.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that weird? And so I read it, and I couldn't put it down. And I pretended I was sick so I could stay home from school. And the part where, spoiler alert, where Gandalf falls into the abyss fighting the Balrog, I actually jumped up, screaming, threw the book across the room, and tears were just pouring down my cheeks. I just couldn't believe that this cruel author had killed off my favorite character.
Luckily, he doesn't stay dead.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's how kind of innocent I was.
Right.
I didn't know about plot and.
So I read that you even tried to turn your bedroom into a hobbit hole.
I did. My parents were funny. I mean, I was an eccentric kid, so.
No.
I got into pipe smoking, and I would go to the
Wait, pipe smoking? You were 12?
I know. Yeah, it's terrible. I couldn't do it very much though, because it like hurt my tongue. Don't smoke pipes, kids. But I would go to the Goodwill and the Salvation Army and like find these old pipes and then like sterilize them. And I had this big pipe collection, and I would go to the tobacconist and buy these different choice tobaccos. And
they sold them to you?
They did.
Like,
that's
here,
that's
kid,
the 80s,
how about...
Early 80s. I would say, I'm buying it for my grandpa.
Mm-hmm. What else did you do to make your bedroom into a hobbit hole?
Oh, God, it was just plastered with Tolkien posters. You know, they had... Back then, you know, you could get all these cool posters. They had the calendars every year. I had all my D&D paraphernalia. Oh, so that's the connection to D&D. When I read The Fellowship of the Ring and they go into the Mines of Moria, I was like, wow, this is just like Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, that's what a goofball I was. I had no idea that the Lord of the Rings had come first.
So let's go over the give an overview of the story. So the Lord of the Rings came out, you know, a few years ago. I mean, the movie version of the book. Tolkien himself wrote The Hobbit first, and he wrote it as a children's book. And now Peter Jackson is making these three movies. So let's just run through the plot really quickly, just in case there are folks out there, as surprising as it may be to you and me, who haven't read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings.
Well, the Hobbit was a children's book, and he wrote it for his kids, and it was published in 1937. And it is the story of Bilbo Baggins, and he is called to come on this adventure with the wizard Gandalf, and he joins this company of dwarves who are trying to reclaim their lost kingdom that was essentially stolen from them by this giant dragon. And Bilbo, in the course of this adventure, finds the One Ring and has this riddle contest with Gollum. And and then at the end, I'm not going to give away the end of the book, but it's the progenitor of the whole Hobbit thing. And the ring. The really interesting thing is that the first version of The Hobbit, Gollum wasn't that bad. He was kind of this nice, kind of funny, sweet creature, and he actually gives the ring to Bilbo when he wins the riddle contest. And so when Tolkien started writing The Lord of the Rings, he realized that he had this backstory for the ring that had been brewing in his mind, and he was like, I have to change this. I have to make Gollum menacing. I have to imbue the ring with all of this nefarious power and you know, show the corruption of it. So he actually rewrote that Riddles in the Dark scene quite extensively.
Huh. Yeah. So he realized that he had written a prequel unintentionally, and the One Ring then became, you know, One Ring to Rule Them All.
Exactly. And I think it in the annals of publishing, I think it might be a unique story that he was actually able to take a book that was very successful and completely rewrite one of the key scenes. Mm. And they publish it. Every edition after that has been published with the new Gollum sequence.
I'm going to take a couple of quick calls. We've got Ray on the line from Rhinelander. Hi, Ray.
Hi. This is really nice. I'm really glad that you people are doing this, because here's the thing, okay? What's really amazing is the history of the book. I'm glad you covered that now, because that was going to be one of my requests, but all the way up to the present and the technology that we have now to go from this book that was written from a creative imagination and now taking it to the technology that we have to have these movies and show the imaginations of this and that and everyone. And it's kind of like a collective creativeness, which in these times of way things are, you know, with the economy and everything else, this is a fantastic, positive, creative way for people to go out and just have hope and use their imagination. I know I'm being elaborate and being surrealistic, but we need more of this.
Well, no, so, and I really love your point that it's almost as though Tolkien started a story, and then it's like a game of, you know, it's passed down through the generations, and now you've got Peter Jackson and his huge crew of movie makers, you know, who are bringing it to life and adding new things to it also. I don't know, Noble, I'm sure you're going to chime in here.
Oh, yeah, I think Ray is right, and that's the thing about the people that are making these movies is that they're making them with immense love, and the art direction is just incredible, and they're putting their hearts and souls into these movies, which doesn't happen a lot. You know, there are some silly kind of gratuitous action sequences and things like that, and they take some liberties with the story, but, you know, it's an adaptation. And I hope somebody does the Hobbit again someday, you know, the 20-part version. Or
that would be great.
Yeah, wouldn't it be awesome?
Yeah. We're talking with Noble Smith. He is a lifelong Tolkien fan, a novelist, a video game writer, documentary film producer, and author of The Wisdom of the Shire. I'm Anne Strangechamps, and when we come back, we will hope to hear more from you. Did you line up to see the new Hobbit movie? Are you a Tolkien nerd yourself? Which book is your favorite? Are there life lessons you've extracted from reading Tolkien? You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 9 tonight, it's the Moth Radio Hour. This week, true romance is put in jeopardy by a reality TV show. A speechwriter has an explosive showdown with Bill Clinton. And a father's courage is put to test in his own home. True stories told live on The Moth at 9 p.m. tonight. I'm Anne Strangechamps, and we are talking about J.R.R. Tolkien and his perennial epics, The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. This weekend, of course, The Hobbit opens. It opened last night at midnight, part two in Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy. And hoping that you will join our conversation, too, at 800-642-1234. Noble Smith is with us. He's the author of The Wisdom of the Shire. And, Noble, we've got some other folks on the line. Let's hear from Ray in Lake Geneva. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, guys. Thank you for the perfectly timed program. I've been a Hobbit fan and a Tolkien fan, just like every other middle-aged man with a little bit of geekdom in them. I was wondering if the author could speak a little bit about the creation that took place in Tolkien's world. It's really remarkable. And as I was sitting here, I was thinking just briefly about how when my son was born, my daughter and I were walking the streets. My wife called and said, I'm in labor. And the message that we gave to Jessica and to my son, Jacob, also was that whenever you step out the door, you're about to have an adventure. if you could please... You know, I finished The Unfinished Tales just a little bit ago. If you can talk a little bit about the creation of the hobbits and just the joy of living, I would appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Sounds great. Noble, have at it.
Yeah, the great call. And that's the thing about hobbits is they – when I was I came up with the idea for this book when I was driving – back from a job interview at Microsoft, and I was stuck in horrible Seattle traffic. And I said to myself, what am I doing? Is this how I want to live my life? It's ridiculous. And I had one of those kind of freeway epiphanies, and this voice spoke to me in my head. It was Ian McKellen as Gandalf saying, it's always been the hobbits. Seek the hobbits. And so when I got home, I was like, all right, I came up with the idea for this when I was a kid. And I always loved hobbits. They're kind and generous and great friends, and they love life and eating and nature, and yet they're courageous when they have to be. And they're these amazing exemplars. And the people who live in the Shire, in the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien talks about this. Everything that they need comes from the Shire, and that's sustainability. And they take only what they need, and that's sufficiency. And so they're just amazing characters.
Are you saying they're like proto-environmentalists?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and I think Tolkien was too. When he would see industrial pollution, he would call it orcery, and it just drove him nuts. And when he was a child, he talked to trees, had long conversations with them. He loved them. So what Ray was talking about was, of course, Bilbo stepping out for this adventure and this poem, The Road Goes Ever On, which is one of the great poems of the 20th century, I think. And so we can all have these great adventures in our life, in our lives, but it's always nice to have a hobbit hole to return home to. And I talk about this in my book.
Yeah, you have a whole section on, what's it called? Something like how to create your own hobbit hole?
It's how snug is your hobbit hole? And what I'm talking about in that chapter isn't, you don't have to live in a beautiful little cottage in the Cotswolds or wherever in England. You can create this ambiance wherever you live, in an apartment in the city or in the suburbs.
And you're talking about, when you say ambiance, you're talking about more than, I don't know, in the movie, it's, you know, sort of a round house and wood-lined, and there's a very generous pantry and the pipes and everything. But you're talking about more than just the appearance.
Yeah, it's what's in your heart and what kind of atmosphere you create with your friends and family. And it doesn't have anything to do with a physical place. And that's something I also learned from reading The Lord of the Rings. And wherever I moved in my life, I always took this one copy of The Lord of the Rings. It was this big red kind of leather-bound version. And I'm not going to say that it was like my Bible or anything, but it was always with me. And when I was sad and I needed to, you know, a little boost, I would always pick up The Lord of the Rings and go to my favorite chapters.
Hmm. We've got another caller on the line. Bernie's calling from Valders. Hi, Bernie.
Hi. I'm a longtime fan, too. I was first introduced to it by a teacher in, I think, maybe the 7th or 8th grade. But I have a little special take on it, because I have this theory about what the inspiration for Lord of the Rings might have been for Tolkien. There was, in the late 19th century, a trilogy written by a man named Henry Sienkiewicz, and it has to do with Polish history. And my dad always used to tell me about these books, that he's from Poland, and he read them as a boy. They were actually banned in Poland before the Second Republic was recreated. And after having read the second book, I don't have the first and last, and watched the 1972 Oscar-nominated film of the second book, which is titled With Fire and Sword, I've become convinced that wholesale sections of that story were simply transposed into The Lord of the Rings.
Why? Is there a one ring to rule them all? Are there elves, hobbits?
Well, there's no rings, but the basis of the story is that the Poles are on the front lines against a variety of Eastern invaders, and the final book, which is titled Colonel Wodeowski, deals at least in part with the Siege of Vienna in the 1600s. And here's one example. The Siege of Vienna was
Actually, Bernie, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you for a second, because I just want to see what Noble has to say, partly because I think what Noble, you might be able to add to this, is that Tolkien was himself, of course, a soldier in World War I, saw trench warfare. And I think that experience did affect some of his writing, didn't it?
It did. It haunted him. He first started writing the concepts behind the Silmarillion right before he went off to the trenches.
The Silmarillion is like the big backstory that kind of sets up the whole, like establishes his whole alternate world.
Yes, it's the mythos behind Middle Earth. And then he went off to this horrible, you know, crazy, insane experience, and most of his friends who he had gone to university with were killed. And then he got trench fever, which I'm convinced were the roots of, like, Frodo's illness that he has after he gets stabbed by the Morgul blade. And also, Tolkien's son Christopher has said that the trenches were the inspiration for the Dead Marshes, the horrible, you know, the battlefield with all the dead.
With all the dead people lying just underneath the surface of water.
Yeah. So, but I don't know what, I've never heard of the books that Bernie was talking about, but I'm sure that, you know, there are many different things that influenced Tolkien. And even Charles Dickens, there's a scene in one of Dickens' books where these people go to an inn and meet a mysterious stranger, and you know, it's like Brie. There's all kinds of things like that.
We've also got Sarah on the line from Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Are you a Tolkien fan?
Yes, definitely. My mother was a librarian in Wisconsin. And in published in 1937 or 38, right in there. And I was 7 or even maybe 6 years old when she brought it home and read it to us. And I think it created in me a love for all English literature.
Hmm.
And
so you must be about 78 or so now?
I am, yes. Hmm. And then when the trilogy came out, we bought it with the 3 books, and there were 3 of us, so we each had a volume of it. And I have all 3.
Originals. Wow, hold on to those. Those are probably first editions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, wow. With the maps.
Oh, that's just great. Sarah, thank you so much for calling. And
I love hearing stories like that.
Yeah, wow. Imagine remembering being read it when it first came out. We've also got Matt, who's calling from Brainerd in Minnesota. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I've been a D&D fan for 22 years. Actually, I'm still playing today, and I'm 38. And both D&D and, Lord of the Rings have brought just so much joy and friends into my life. The friends I made when I first started gaming are still my friends today. I mean, and it's just, you know, those two guys really brought people that were shy and introverted together where we never could get together before.
Hmm.
And it's just amazing how much that, you know, those two people in our world have
I'm curious.
So many people out.
Yeah, Matt, I'm curious because, you know, I was a shy, introverted, bookworm kid too. And what is it, do you think, about the imaginary Tolkien kind of world that so appeals to kids like that and then can bring them together with other kids like them?
Well, I think what it is it allows us to, you know, almost everybody is shy and introverted. We have really active imagination. And it allows us to imagine what we could be in life. And I think that what that does is helps build our own inner confidence because, hey, I'm a elf warrior. I know I can be in our imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that builds confidence in our real life, too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks for the call. Noble, I'm curious about, you've called Tolkien the first alternate reality historian, I think. I was thinking one of the appeals for, you know, the shy, the introverted, especially teenagers of the Tolkien books is it's like you can finally just leave this world, which is so problematic, especially if you're in high school, leave it behind and enter this other wonderful world where there are elves and hobbits and magic.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it. And the reason I wrote my book was because I wanted to show how you could take the lessons that are in these books and apply them to the real world. And that's what's so cool about The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And
for example, I mean, you've got a chapter in The Wisdom of the Shire on the idea that we all have our own personal golem.
Yes, your OPG.
Own personal golem. Okay, can you play that out a bit?
Well, I just thought that everybody has somebody in their life that is like this golem-like creature, somebody who comes into your life, you don't really want them, and it could be a friend or a relative or even an enemy, somebody at work, and they kind of make your life miserable. They're like psychic vampires, which is what Gollum is like.
But at the same time, you can't quite get rid of them. Or maybe you need them in your life?
Maybe you need them. Maybe you need to learn a lesson from them. But that's one of the most amazing things about The Lord of the Rings is that Frodo endures Gollum. He tries to change him, but he can't. There's no way to make him change. He's been too corrupted by the ring. But because he shows Gollum mercy, Gollum in the end ends up saving the day. And because Frodo fails, and it's only because he showed mercy to Gollum that the ring can finally be destroyed.
There's Gollum also bites off his finger in the process.
Spoiler! You're supposed to say spoiler.
Spoiler. Sorry. Is there anybody who hasn't seen the...
I don't know.
I suppose there probably are.
I'm thinking there's like some 9-year-old kid.
Okay. So what else? You've also got a chapter on, dwarves, hobbits, and Sackville Bagginses.
Dwarves, dragons, and the Sackville Bagginses.
Okay, you're going to have to remind us who the Sackville Bagginses are.
The Sackville Bagginses were Bilbo's super greedy cousins, and they coveted Bag End and thought that they should have inherited it. And so that chapter is all about greed and what we can learn from Tolkien about not being greedy people, because the dwarves have this lust for gold and jewels, and that's what drives them to go back to Erebor, to the Lonely Mountain, to try to reclaim all of this wealth from Smaug. And for Thorin, it ends up being his downfall. It's this greed, and it's only on Thorin's deathbed that he finally comes to this realization that it was a chimera, it was just an illusion. And the thing that was most important was his friendship with Bilbo. And so this is Thorin speaking, this is a quote from The Hobbit. "If more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world." And a lot of people think that that's Bilbo, because that quote is out there on the internet. But it's actually Thorin.
Hmm. Well, that's relevant to us today. I'm thinking about the banking crisis and everything that sparked the recession. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Noble Smith. He's a lifelong Tolkien fan, a novelist, video game writer, film producer, and the author of The Wisdom of the Shire, which is what we're talking about, life lessons to be found in The Hobbit. And I'm Anne Strangechamps, and we are hoping that you will join the conversation, too. Curious, what have epic stories like The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit taught you? Has one of these stories helped you, or do you just still love them, and if so, why? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Anne Strangechamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 10 tonight, it's Snap Judgment. This week, monsters. They've destroyed Tokyo. They've climbed to the top of the Empire State Building. We're hunting the biggest of them all. That's Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat at 10 tonight. I'm Anne Strangechamps. We're talking about J.R.R. Tolkien's epics, The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, with Noble Smith. He's the author of The Wisdom of the Shire. And Noble, we've got Eric on the line from Milwaukee. Let's see what he's got to say. Hey, Eric.
Good morning and happy holiday seasons to you both.
And to you.
Thank you.
I was wondering if either of you are familiar with a team of artists called the Brothers Hildebrandt.
Excellent.
And perhaps, Noble, you know to what extent their artwork has influenced what is the commonly, you know, represented as being a hobbit. And if you could talk about them or what you know about them, it would be appreciated.
Oh, great. So they were some of the original artists of the...
They were artists who, as far as I know, what we consider or regard to what a hobbit looks like, they really hit the nail right on the head in terms of, you know, just everything about the hobbit and the culture and Gandalf and everything. Their artwork is more like sorcery, fantasy type of art, and they have a book with, from cover to cover, it's nothing but hobbit, Lord of the Rings type art.
Okay, thanks. Noble, tell us what you know about them.
Yeah, the brothers Hildebrandt were twins. They were these genius painters who painted in kind of a Renaissance style. I mean, they were like old masters. And they were some of the first artists back in the late 60s and early 70s to create like calendar art and do renditions of scenes from Tolkien that were like just incredibly dramatic, and they're still brilliant to this day. And I think they had a lot of influence on artists like John Howe and Alan Lee, who are also Tolkien artists and have been the art designers. Exactly.
Right. Tolkien did some of his own illustrations, didn't he? Especially for The Hobbit.
Oh, he was a brilliant amateur artist, and so the first cover of The Hobbit was actually done by Tolkien, and you can see it now in the mini version at bookstores. It's like a pocket edition, and it's this cool kind of mountain with trees, and it's very kind of symmetrical, and he did the illustrations that are in a lot of editions of The Hobbit.
I have to tell you where else you can see that, which I'm always surprised how few people in Wisconsin know this. Marquette University has most of Tolkien's manuscripts. He sold them to them, and you can see them at the Rare Book Room there.
If I lived there, I would probably be going there like once a week.
I have a road trip scheduled.
Yeah, and Ethan Gilsdorf in Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks talks about this. He actually went there, and he got to hold the illustration that Tolkien did for the Mines of Moria door, which is in every edition of The Lord of the Rings, and that was actually drawn by him.
Wow. I don't think they'll let just anybody touch the stuff, but I do know that you can go and they've got, I think Tolkien himself, I can't remember when it was, maybe somebody from Marquette will call and tell us, I don't remember when it was that Tolkien sold the Hobbit manuscript and maybe some of the Lord of the Rings manuscripts to Marquette, but it was before everything got big, obviously, because he still could use the money. They're there, and you can go and visit them.
Yeah, and the only reason that there are movies right now is because Tolkien sold, a couple of years before he died, sold the movie rights for about £100,000, which was a lot of money back then. But
consider what those movies have made.
Right, and the only reason he did it was so that his children could retain the rights to his books, because back then the inheritance taxes were so high that his family would have lost control of the books completely.
Oh, that's interesting. We've got Renee joining us from East Troy. Hey, Renee.
Hi. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the TV personality Stephen Colbert is a huge Tolkien fan. He's brought this topic up on his show many times.
I didn't know that.
Oh, in 2013, I think, he entered a competition, I think it was in England, I could be wrong about that, but where he went up against, you know, some of the world's foremost Tolkien experts, and he won.
Really?
So. Actually, that contest was, he was visiting the film set in New Zealand and for The Hobbit, and he entered this contest with the writers, Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh, who are the co-screenwriters of all of the Lord of the Rings movies. And he, like, mopped the floor with them. The guy is a savant.
That's really fascinating. So, Noble, I'm curious, you know how with some of the other film franchises that have been huge, like, well, and the books, Harry Potter and Twilight, their fan fiction has sprung up. Is there Tolkien fan fiction?
There's lots of Tolkien fan fiction.
Is it any of it any good?
Yeah, some of it's okay. I mean, the problem with it is that it's almost impossible to write like Tolkien did and not have it sound stilted.
Because he wrote in that kind of high epic style?
He did. And that's exactly what it's called, the high style. And but I think there's some amazing story. One of the callers talked about the book Unfinished Tales, which has some like unfinished scenes that he wrote. And one of those they use in the second Hobbit movie. And it was a chapter about Gandalf meeting Thorin in Bree. So it's really cool. When you watch The Desolation of Smaug, it actually starts out back in time with Gandalf meeting Thorin at the Prancing Pony.
It's really astonishing what Tolkien did. I don't know if he was the first person to create this kind of, what do they call it, alternate world fantasy, where it's way more than a book. You know, it's the maps and the geography and the languages and then with the Silmarillion, which frankly I found unreadable, but, you know, this dense kind of encyclopedic backlog. Was he the first person to do that?
Well, yeah, I think so. And he was he was the progenitor of the fantasy world creation. And he called it subcreation. So it was almost like he was a godlike entity and he was creating a world. To him, I think the world of Middle Earth was more real to Tolkien than the place where he lived. And his son, Christopher, said this in an interview recently, that the world of the Silmarillion was more real to him than the tales from the Bible, because he had just been infused with this mythology.
Hmm. How did he invent it all? I mean, do you think he just always had this world in his head and then it was just a matter of putting it down, or do you think he consciously, you know, worked at it all the time?
I think it was, it was a confluence of all of these things. It was his war experience, facing death at a very young age. It was his linguistic background, all of his work as a philologist and studying languages and mythology. And he wanted to create what he called a mythology for the English people that he thought was lacking.
No, because ancient Greece had the ancient Greek myths and the Norse countries had the Scandinavian myths, but England didn't have anything?
Right. Yeah, they had the Arthurian legend.
Right, King Arthur.
Which he was totally into, and Beowulf. But yeah, I think he was a little mad, and I think you have to be to come up with something that's this rich.
Well, I'm curious if this notion of creating a myth or finding the mythos that underlies your life, I wonder if you would consider that to be one of the lessons of the Shire or of Tolkien. I mean, do you try to see your own life in kind of mythic terms?
I do, yeah, and I talk about that in the book, and especially near the end in a chapter called The Light of Arendil. I won't go into the mythology of who Arendil was, but it's this idea that we're all on an adventure in life. And a lot of times we forget that, and we become so wrapped up in the need to make money and our weird insecurities that prevent us from forming really great relationships with our family and friends. And sometimes we just have to step back and say, what kind of person do I want to be? What do I want the tale of my life to end up like?
Well, the other thing I was thinking is, I think Sam says it in The Lord of the Rings, you know, you can't see your own life as mythic or grand. You just see it as a series of, you know, kind of hapless adventures and mistakes. And it's only, you know, often it's only at the end of your life, really, that you look back, you know, like our caller who's 78 or some other people, you look back and you begin to see the overall shape and trajectory of your life. And you realize, oh my gosh, it has been, you know, a quest or a myth of some sort or another.
That's really cool. And what do we want to be important? You know, I know that on my deathbed, I'm not going to say, gosh, I wish I hadn't spent so much time with my kids. Jeez.
Yeah.
And one of the beautiful things about the end of The Lord of the Rings is the final moment of the book. After all these adventures and war and, you know, slaying of orcs, it's a guy coming back home to his little house and putting his daughter on his lap and saying, I'm home.
Are there, Tolkien was such an educated man, a professor at Oxford. Is there a deeper philosophy kind of underlying some of his writing that, you know, we might not realize? And I've read there are, I don't know, parallels with Plato in some cases, or maybe St. Thomas Aquinas or Ralph Waldo Emerson.
There are so many different influences. I don't know if he was trying to write like a Christian allegory. And he used to hate it when people would say that the ring is like, you know, the atomic bomb. But all of these things, I mean, he was a devoted Catholic. But one of the really interesting things about The Lord of the Rings is there's no mention of God in the entire trilogy. There are the godlike creatures, the Valar. But nobody in The Lord of the Rings prays.
And what do you make of that?
I think he was able to kind of separate his world from the world of Christianity. And I think C.S. Lewis, his friend, who was writing the Narnia books, kind of had all of that Christian allegory covered, so you didn't have to worry about it.
Do you think that's why Tolkien's books are, in some ways, have held on to their popularity and the perenniality of their appeal, because there's something religious or mystical about them, and yet they're very secular? As you said, there's no mention of God.
I think so, and they're universal. Anybody in the world can read the book and get it.
So you also have, I have to ask you about one last lesson from The Shire. There's one more chapter you've got I want to ask you about. How do we carry the burden of our own ring of power? And what do you mean by that?
We might have something in our past that was traumatic that we just can't let go of, like Frodo couldn't let go of that ring. In the end, you just have to take whatever it is inside of you that's holding you back, and you have to toss it into that pit of lava and watch it melt.
Which is harder than it may seem. Are you also suggesting that, I don't know, that Tolkien is suggesting to us that the things that are most toxic to us bind themselves to us, and it's often to the point that it's hard to let them go?
It is. It is so hard to let these things go, and that's why Frodo's degeneration into kind of madness because of the corruption of the ring is pretty remarkable. And whoever comes into contact with this thing is corrupted by it. Even Sam has these delusions of grandeur when he puts it on just for a little bit.
Well, Noble, for people who have been listening and are recalling their love of Tolkien, or for people who go see the Hobbit movie and, you know, you always have that terrible feeling when the movie ends and you think, oh, no, now what do I do? Anything you'd suggest we go read?
Oh, my gosh. Well, and if you go see The Desolation of Smaug, you are going to get that feeling big time, because it's probably the biggest cliffhanger in the history of movies.
I hate that.
And it was very bold of them to do it. I was kind of shocked that they ended it where they did. and the whole audience just went, oh, because, you know, they know they have to wait an entire year.
So what do we go read?
You can go to the Huffington Post and look up my latest blog about the 15 great books to give for the holidays.
Okay.
That will grace any Tolkien lover's library.
Tell you what, we'll post it on our Facebook page on 45 North on WPR. Noble, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Anne. It was great talking to you.
And Noble Smith.
To all your callers.
Thanks. Noble Smith is a lifelong Tolkien fan and author of The Wisdom of the Shire. This hour was produced by Marika Suval. Dave Potraz made sure we all stayed on the air and sounded good and hit all the breaks when we were supposed to. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio.